Welcome to the Government Gurus Podcast, hosted by Alex Bennett. Each episode of The Gurus discusses important concepts such as constitutional principles, philosophical foundations, the structure of the Constitution, and the balance of power between the federal government and state governments. Each episode brings special guests who share their expertise about the important questions we face about our constitutional democracy. This is The Government Gurus.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Government Gurus. My name is Alex Bennett, and today I'm here with Dr. Lindsay Chervinsky, author of the new book entitled The Cabinet, and it discusses George Washington and the first cabinet of the United States of America. So, Dr. Chervinsky, I'd like to welcome you to the podcast, and if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself to our listeners.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. I am a historian at the White House Historical Association, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan history organization. And my passion is really early American history. And I think it's so important to understand where the government and the country came from in order to better inform where we are at this current moment. So that's what I try and accomplish with my work.
Yeah, the White House Historical Association, is that right by the actual White House? Is it down where the White House Visitor Center is? Is that where you're located?
So we do have a relationship with the Visitor Center. We help run that, but our offices are actually at the historic Decatur House, which is right on the corner of Lafayette Park on H Street in Jackson Place. So
okay.
So not only do we have the history mission of the White House, we also are in a historic building, which is really cool in its own right.
Oh, good. Well, I have to, like I said, when we were texting or sending tweets, that I'll have to get a tour, because one of my former students, I got a tour like the West Wing. So we got like a really full tour. We bowled in the Truman Bowling Alley. So it was really intense.
Oh, so that's fantastic.
I think, and I have to give a shout out, I think I found you on Twitter from Julie Silverbrook, who was at the Constitutional consource.org, she was on the podcast, and she's now left for iCivics, but I think she tweeted about your new book, and then I was like, oh, and then I followed it, and I put it on my wish list, so I gotta order it off my wish list. I'm debating on whether or not to get hardcover or Kindle, because I do like old books, but I like highlighting and be able to highlight electronically and remember. I like that, not damaging the book, of course.
Yes. Well, if this helps persuade you or your readers, I have designed a personalized book plate, because we're not allowed to do in-person signings right now. And so the book plate is a little sticker, and it has a hound up top, because I have a foxhound that frequently makes appearances on my social media channels. Nice. And anyone who buys the book and sends me a picture, I will send you a signed personalized book plate. So that has been a fun way to go about connecting with readers.
Well, I'm totally doing that then. So I'll get the hardcover.
Yes.
Yeah, well, good. All
right,
so first of all, let's do the plug for your book. So you wrote a book about the cabinet, and we teach about it for AP government, and this is what the podcast is designed for, AP government, and we talk about the cabinet really when we obviously get to the executive. So what made you want to write about this first cabinet here under Washington?
Yeah, so the cabinet, as I'm sure all of the listeners know, isn't actually in the Constitution. And so when I started trying to research Washington's administration and read more about the cabinet, I was looking for where it actually came from. And I couldn't find any books on the origin of the institution. And of course, there's a lot on Jefferson and Hamilton and Washington and their relationships, but nothing about where that body came from. And it turns out that the last book that was actually published on it was in 1912, and was a sort of an overview of the different legislations that were passed to create each department. And so I wanted to know like more about the practices and the evolution and the emergence. And so I basically decided that I was going to answer that question of where did it come from? And in doing so, I actually discovered this, what I think is an amazing story, that Washington created the cabinet to be a personal advisory body so that he could, you know, get advice and support whenever he needed it. But it was very much supposed to be at the president's pleasure. And so every president since then has had a cabinet, but they all look really different. And each president gets to decide who their closest advisors are going to be and how they're going to have those relationships. And those take place with very little public or congressional oversight. And so I sort of stumbled into this like much larger story than I was anticipating, but one that I think has a lot of contemporary significance.
All right. So you kind of answer the first question that, so there's really no constitutional basis for the cabinet, but what can the president create offices as he sees fit, or is it just, this was just done by the legislation that you were kind of digging up?
Yeah, great question. So the president can't create offices at will, but he or she has the right to basically consult with whoever they want to. And most presidents end up doing some combination of maybe a couple of cabinet secretaries that they have close relationships to, maybe some people that sort of work in the president's staff, like the chief of staff, maybe some people on the National Security Council. Obama was particularly close to Vice President Joe Biden. Yeah. That's a more unusual circumstance. Usually vice presidents don't always get along with the presidents. So it really depends on who the person is. So they can't really create offices, but they can request advice. And that is a fairly unusual situation when we look at forms of government. Usually the advisors are elected or they're in other forms of office. And so this circumstance that we have in the Constitution is really much more fluid and organic and depends on who's in the office.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I've noticed while teaching about the cabinet and the ascendancy of the presidency, that the Secretary of State was seen as the springboard into the office. I think Madison, Monroe, Jefferson, was it maybe John Quincy Adams? I think weren't all of them at one time part of the cabinet and the Secretary of State, correct?
Yes. Okay. Yes. So Jefferson was Washington's Secretary of State. Then Madison was Jefferson's. Monroe was Madison's. John Quincy Adams was Monroe's. And then that sort of, that trend kind of tapers off. There are a couple of more examples here and there sparkled throughout history, but by and large, early on, that was really the idea, that it was one of the, you were going to put someone in the Secretary of State who was really powerful, who was really experienced and knowledgeable, and probably was going to end up being either a rival or a successor.
Okay. The original, can you tell us for the listeners, because the cabinet, I believe, is really often overlooked, I think, in a sense, for like AP government standpoint. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think you see a lot of it, the significance of the cabinet play out politically, like in real life. So it's not talked about in the textbook, but in real life, you see this. So what were the four original cabinet positions?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's not usually focused on too much in terms of government. The four original positions were the Secretary of State, the Secretary of War, the Secretary of the Treasury, and then the Attorney General, which the Attorney General did not have a department like it does today. Yeah. It was really more of a constitutional advisor to the president and then to the other secretaries as well. They frequently, in Washington's cabinet, the other secretaries would consult with whoever was the Attorney General about a constitutional question or the legality of some sort of issue.
Okay. Yeah, and I think to piggyback that, so the AP, they like to know the line of succession when, if a president, you know, dies in office or resigns or whatnot, or is incapable of functioning. It's like, okay, what are the offices? And so we tell the students, like, it's the first, you know, it goes in the order of the first four, and then every cabinet added to that is the line of succession. So we always end up, the last one is the Department of Homeland Security, since they are the last cabinet created, which is, I mean, God, you think back, like 9/11 was, you know, almost 19 years ago. And at the time, I mean, I was just in college, and it's like, oh, there's a cabinet position. And I didn't really think anything of it. And then you realize it's like, ah, it's a very interesting thing that the Congress had created it. So the four was Attorney General, Secretary of War, State and Treasury. Students, I think, now familiar that they changed from war to defense, which, you know, I guess is a good thing. You don't want a guy just, you know, hell bent on war, but defense sounds much better. But so you said it's an advisory body, and I sent a question. So, I mean, I guess you can look at historically or even today. So what's the purpose now that, the government and the international issues are probably way beyond what Washington and the founders could comprehend. So what, like today, would you say the role of the cabinet is, and maybe how influential it has been, or are they?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, well, as you alluded to, the size of the government and the scope of its activity is very different than in the 18th century. Although one of the things that I do make the argument about in the book is that the executive branch was much more powerful than people think it was. And that was an active choice by Washington and the secretaries. They really actively carved out executive authority over domestic and diplomatic issues. And so that was very intentional on their part and set the stage for periods of executive power and growth of executive power going forward. But they were, I mean, so when Washington gathered the secretaries as an advisory body, it was to provide support and advice, not to deal with their daily administrative tasks, which they tended to dispatch either in writing or in individual consultations. And in a lot of ways, that is really the emphasis of today's cabinet. The secretaries manage these very large bureaucracies and oversee policy on behalf of the president. But I would argue that a really effective cabinet actually is created when a president surrounds himself with people who maybe have different perspectives and different ideological opinions about things or are really passionate about certain issues, and provides support and advice to the president on how to best pursue those policies. And so that advisory component, and even necessarily like almost like pushing the president to be better in that area, is where a cabinet can really excel. Now, these things you tend not to see. So a really successful cabinet is actually usually blends into the background, because all of its successes should go to the president. And usually that person gets the acclaim and the fame, and it seems like the administration is running really well. When we see the cabinet is when it tends to have dysfunction or scandal, or things start to kind of break down, and then it becomes very visible.
Yeah. And I point out to, you know, as a teacher, look no further than the, you know, Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, and her confirmation hearing, and how problematic that brought attention to these cabinet picks, because it was, I believe, the first time ever it was a 50-50 split that had to be decided by the vice president to make her a cabinet secretary. So I think you've seen, you know, for students, we talk about obviously the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell. I think in my teaching experience and little going into college, those are the ones that you really, really focus on or you hear about. I don't necessarily hear too much from the Treasury unless it's, you know, maybe stimulus. Or maybe Secretary of Defense, maybe, but you know, growing up, early 21st century is more, you know, President Bush making decisions rather than the Secretary of Defense. So, so the other question I wanted, has besides sheer size, has the original intent or the original purpose of the cabinet, has that evolved? Has that changed since Washington, how he envisioned it? And have presidents like worked to try to encapsulate that idea of a cabinet that Washington had and carry it with them forward into their presidency?
It really depends on the president. So one of the things that I really took away from this project is I started to sort of look past Washington and see what precedent remained and how it may have evolved, is that the administration of the cabinet is one of the greatest reflections of presidential leadership. And so presidents who are really good at managing other people and managing different perspectives and agendas. I mean, because we have to keep in mind the people being appointed to these positions, especially early on, they were politically very active. They were very opinionated. They were probably pretty egotistical. They were ambitious. And so that naturally led to some conflict. And even today, when we tend to focus on there's more of a professionalization of some of these positions, these are still people who have, you know, decades of experience in their various careers or industry. And so they are accustomed to being listened to. And so it really is a challenge for any president to try and manage all of those people. It's an almost impossible task. And so the presidents who do really well with it, they haven't necessarily all used the same strategies. So for example, FDR had a very successful cabinet. He had a very diverse cabinet. He was the first president to appoint a woman to a cabinet secretary position. He had Republicans in his cabinet, especially during the war years, because he really wanted to have that unity in his administration. And he basically played people off of each other in all aspects of his administration and allowed them to pursue their own sort of agendas and their own aims and sort of all on behalf of his administration. And then whoever kind of came out on top or who came up with the best strategy, he would go with. Now, that is not a strategy that would work for everyone, because that inherently sort of invites some conflict and might be kind of awkward. But he was a really fantastic politician at sort of manipulating all those different personalities. Jefferson, on the other hand, Jefferson had, again, a very successful cabinet. He had the least turnover in cabinet history. And he hated conflict. And so he was very careful to try and craft a very congenial cabinet atmosphere. He didn't let the secretaries meet all that much because he didn't want there to be disagreement. He didn't want there to be factions. And so he only convened a cabinet meeting when he felt like it would be really productive and it would be a conversation that would get him and the administration to a place that they wanted to get to. And so those are, you know, very different approaches, but they worked because they were able to manage the personalities that they were dealing with at the time. And it's when presidents can't manage that or don't manage that or kind of take a hands-off approach, like Madison, for example, that it can sometimes blow up in your face.
Yeah, but wasn't it Madison's secretary? I'm trying to think. I was listening to a podcast. It was Madison's secretary of state or defense that blundered the defense of Washington at Blandensburg. What was his name? Ugh. And he ended up getting rid of him.
Robert Smith was one of the secretaries who was particularly problematic. He was Jefferson's secretary of the Navy, mm-hmm. and Jefferson managed him really well, but then he kind of ran roughshod all over Madison and mm-hmm. caused a lot of problems.
Maybe that was it. Yeah, it was. So I was talking about these personality conflicts. So it sounds that you would think FDR and Jefferson probably had the strongest cabinets. Think of like modern, maybe like under President Obama or President Trump. Is there any relationship, are they more loyal to their Secretary of Education, their agency? Are they more loyal to that agency than they are the president, or are those goals specifically aligned with the president?
Well, in some ways, it's really hard to say, because a lot of the evidence and the archival material that we would use to analyze that question is classified. And so it won't be declassified for several decades. And that's really one of the fascinating things about history, is it really evolves as you have more access to material. So, for example, a lot of people thought at the time that Eisenhower was kind of old and doddering and not really paying attention and was very much managed by his secretaries and, you know, not really paying attention, was just a figurehead. Turns out he was actually incredibly involved in every decision and was a total taskmaster, had a weekly cabinet meeting that he was very strict about, was on top of everything, was very hierarchical and very disciplined. And it wasn't until the records were declassified that we actually got that picture of Eisenhower. So all we have right now is what's in the news and what is made available by, you know, sort of publication. And so it will be very interesting to see in a couple of decades what sort of the materials reveal to us about more contemporary presidencies. Okay. I will say, I mean, the professionalization of the bureaucracies and the departments has made them in some ways less political positions, or they're sort of supposed to be less political positions. But the secretaries, of course, they do serve at the pleasure of the president. And so that is a fine line between having to have that loyalty to the purpose of the department and the people who, the public servants who give decades of their life to that service, and to, you know, pursuing the agenda that has been set out by the president.
Hmm. Okay. Well, that pretty, yeah. Okay. So that really answers the question of, you know, the, I guess time will tell, right, with it, how involved with the relationship. And I guess the media has a, you know, big influence, because it seems like today, you know, under President Trump, there is a lot of turmoil in his cabinet with high turnover. And I think maybe that's a judgment, you know, the media and the people make, like, well, how effective is that the president managing the cabinet and issues when you have such a high turnover for these cabinet positions, especially like higher ones like the defense and state?
Yeah, well, so I mean, for my position, I can't really make a judgment because I have to remain nonpartisan and nonpolitical. But I will say, from a purely numbers standpoint, so not passing judgment on any candidate or anything like that, but from a pure numbers standpoint, this has been an unprecedented rate of turnover. The more recent presidents in my lifetime, both Bushes, Clinton, and Obama, generally had 1 to 2 secretaries for at least the really big positions, like Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, Secretary of Treasury, things like that. Mm-hmm. So just based purely on the numbers, you can go and look at Wikipedia and it will tell you, you know, the people that have been in the various cabinet positions, and you can compare for yourself.
Yeah, and that's what it's there for. So what does a president look for? So what qualifications do you need? Because I believe, you know, when we look at Secretary of Education, the last two, Betsy DeVos, and, well, I can't remember the one between Arne Duncan, but Arne Duncan, I don't believe either of them were school teachers or involved in education, really, in the public school systems. So what qualifications, if any, do you need for these positions?
Well, I mean, I guess in some ways it's a matter of what you can get past the Senate, right? In terms of like a purely political, yeah. In terms of a purely political calculation, it's a matter of what you can get the Senate to approve. The precedent that Washington established, which has been by and large for the most part followed pretty closely, is that you want to have people that have expertise in the cabinet that the president does not. So, for example, Washington had only left the country once when he was a teenager. He went to Barbados, but he had never served in a diplomatic position before. He didn't speak French, which was the language of diplomacy. Those were very important characteristics that Jefferson brought to the cabinet, because he did have that expertise and could answer questions that Washington wouldn't be able to. Similarly, while Washington certainly understood Hamilton's financial plans, he didn't have the like really creative financial mind to come up with new solutions to problems. So he was very attentive to his own limitations and wanted to make sure he had people that could help, you know, fill those out. That was one of his greatest strengths as a leader. And he also made sure, and this is another important thing that presidents have really followed, is that the cabinet needed to reflect the diversity of the nation. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, they were all white men, so yeah. That definition of diversity is a little bit limited and has, of course, expanded over the centuries, which I'm grateful for. But, you know, they were from different states. They were from different backgrounds. They had gotten their education in different places. Jefferson was a slave-owning plantation owner, whereas Hamilton was, you know, kind of cozied up to the merchant trade elite in New York City. And so Washington knew that by bringing together all of these people, he was helping the country see itself in the administration and helping the country establish important emotional ties to the federal government. And so most presidents have followed that example. And as I said, the definition of diversity has expanded. So Obama had one of the most diverse cabinets in history in terms of race and religion and gender and, you know, everything else under the sun you could imagine.
Hmm. Yeah, I think one of the things that people read about with Washington and understand that he had these insecurities and he knew that, and he worked really to no end to make sure he fixed those and he could counteract his weaknesses and strengthen him through through others. And he was very, very good at that. And I think he did this excellent assessment or analysis on that founding. And I think many, I mean, just the sheer size, I tell my students all the time is that a president can't know everything. I mean, it's impossible. Right. So you have
Yeah. And no one expected the president to ever lead alone, and they shouldn't be expected to lead alone.
But I think if you look at the voters and if you look at the media and how people respond to any president, it's like, how did this happen? How did he not know? And then it's like, well, he's got a million things going on. He's not going to know. And he needs these experts. He relies on him. And if there's a break in any of that, I mean, it could be very damaging to the nation and to the presidency. So, well, we've been going for almost 25 minutes. So I'd like you to, two more questions. First, which cabinet position do you think yields the most power or has the most influence on the president? And you can't say it depends on what president.
Oh man. Well, that was totally my answer. Because it totally does depend on the president and who's in office. But I think that in the 1790s, I think it was the Secretary of State because diplomatic issues were so pressing and the possibility of war was so constant. And the possibility of war with great imperial nations was, you know, a very real danger when the United States literally did not have an army or a navy. So fighting a war was a terrifying prospect. But today, I think probably the Attorney General, because Department of Justice has such incredible oversight over so many aspects of citizenship and rights, and it has the ability to really set a tone for what citizenship is going to be and what is going to be valued and protected in a way that few other departments have that sort of ability to shape culture. So I think that's probably today one of the most important.
I would agree with you because I think with the divided government of Congress, and I talk to my students about this, legislation doesn't get passed. And so, you know, Hamilton argues, I think, was it Federalist 78 with the judicial branch being the weakest. I think it's one of the most powerful. And I think the people are turning to the courts to get these decisions. And now they're looking for the Attorney General to say, what is the legal, how's the president going to, what's the White House think? What does the executive branch think? And he lays it out. And I think people turn and say, well, if the Attorney General is saying this, then maybe this is the legality and this is the process which that the government is going to take, albeit whether it be it right or wrong. And so I guess finally, my final question is, I don't know if you can answer it.
More point about that? Mm-hmm. I think it's also really important for people to actually look at what is written down. And then what has so much of the United States government is not actually written down and instead has been built upon custom and practice. Mm-hmm. And so that is something that I think I really take away from this project, the cabinet, is that when we look at Article 2, it's incredibly short, especially compared to Article 1. There's very little actually detailed about what the president should be doing day to day. And even if you added up all of the legislation, and this is especially true for the presidency, but then also the judicial branch, as you mentioned, so much of what governs their behavior is not actually written down. And so I think that one of the things that we've witnessed in the last couple of years is how much we rely on custom to shape behavior and, you know, what happens when that starts to break down and how do we feel about that? And what does that say about our democracy? And I think those are all really important questions to consider.
Yeah. I was reading a book on, the Cult of the Constitution, and it kind of talks about, and I've read like Amar with, you know, the written and unwritten constitution and customs. It's like, well, when these are standard customs that have been around for centuries and all of a sudden they start to change, people that really can kind of erupt and cause as contention amongst the people, and it can, you know, changes, it shapes the nation, and then some of the cabinet, like attorney general, might have to respond to it, and whether it be it by law or by, you know, by custom, they have to make the decision. So it's always fascinating because it is written and unwritten rules that govern this country, and it just really depends on the issue and the perspective that you have, and how you're going to assess how one of the presidents are going to do. So I don't know if you can answer this last question because you're supposed to be nonpartisan, but who's had the best cabinet and who's had the worst?
I can mostly answer that. So the best, I would say, you know, Jefferson, Lincoln, FDR, maybe even Eisenhower, kind of your, you know, expected top presidents, things like that. Although Jefferson's presidency, by and large, was maybe not as successful, but the cabinet was really good at implementing his policies, even if the policies were just bad.
Yeah.
Or turned out to be bad. In terms of worst, I would say Jackson's was incredibly detrimental and just unbelievably chaos-causing. Yeah. Johnson's, Andrew Johnson's, of course, led to he tried to dismiss Stanton, who was the Secretary of War, and that got him impeached or almost impeached. Then I would say, you know, like Wilson had a fairly chaotic cabinet because he was not able to wrangle the different ideological perspectives. Mm-hmm. The last one I would say is, you know, Kennedy had sort of a conflicting cabinet because he had two. He had a real cabinet and he had a kitchen cabinet.
Yeah.
And that can cause a lot of chaos when you have two different bodies that are operating at sometimes cross purposes, and it's not necessarily clear where policy is actually coming from. So ideally, in a perfect world, if you were to draw it up, that would not be the case. And then I will leave it there and allow others to draw their conclusions based on their own assessment of precedent and contemporary politics.
Okay. And finally, if you were going to tell students in the country one thing, what was the one thing that they should know about the cabinet?
One thing they should know about the cabinet. I think the one thing I would say is, you know, it is a very organic body. It's not in the Constitution, and so it can shift and change depending on every single administration, and is a great way to evaluate because it is so fluid and so different for each president. It is a great way to evaluate an administration.
Well, Dr. Javinsky, thank you so much for coming on. You can buy her book. It is on Amazon, Kindle, and hardcover. I was looking for the soft cover, but hardcover. And you can follow her on Twitter. Let me get this right. It's at LM Chervinsky is the handle. Is there anywhere else they can follow you on social media, or is it just Twitter?
Twitter is where I am most active. My website is also lindseychervinsky.com. And so I have a bunch of my writings and videos and events there. So if anyone wants to read more or learn about anything else, you can always do that.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on, and thank you so much. And hopefully we'll have you on again.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you.